So finally, the theme that we chose for the forum is one of diversity. So I want to invite you all to take a moment and look around at what a diverse and lively group we are. And without further ado, the man who essentially brought us all together as a community, Bill Miller.
Well, I find this talk about MI elephants a little disturbing because I'm not sure what that makes me. I must be an MI dinosaur at this point, I guess, right? Yeah. Well, MI is certainly an organic process. It's something that's always changing, and it was only about 5 years into the release of MI2 that Steve and I began feeling like that's outdated. It came out in 2002, but so much happened so fast that we certainly are at a point now where the way in which many of us are teaching MI is quite different from the way it's expressed in the second edition of Motivational Interviewing. So Steve and I have started on the process of writing the third edition, with the goal of finishing it by next summer and having it out in 2012. The first one, as you know, was 1991, and it was very focused on addictions. That's where the MI began. But by the time the second edition rolled around, it had gone far past the addiction field and so became a book more generally about how to facilitate change. And we're working on the third one now for 2012. And by that schedule, you might anticipate there'd be an MI4 in 2022. And Steve and I agreed that we have to stop there because otherwise it would be MI5. So what's changing? I already hear people moaning, oh, I have to change my slides. Yeah, right, yeah. Well, there were five principles to motivational interviewing in the first edition, and then, as you know, we shot one. And so Steve and I have thought about what to do about the principles this time, and this is what we decided to do. That disembodied principles that you kind of list on the board in an introductory lecture don't necessarily capture MI well. And we're taking a different approach than talking about generalized principles. We also are letting go of the two phases, phase one and phase two, for a variety of reasons that I think will become apparent. But happily, what's not changing is the underlying spirit of motivational interviewing, which continues to focus on a collaborative partnership relationship between the interviewer and the person, the evocation of the person's own wisdom and motivation, which has always been central to motivational interviewing, and honor and respect for the autonomy of the person and the choices that they make. David. I'll see what I can do, or maybe somebody can do a volume adjustment, huh? But I'll see what I can do. Thank you. Yeah. We did, however, decide to add a fourth element to the spirit of motivational interviewing, something that we feel rounds it out. Because you could be someone who sells used cars and do each of these three things. In fact, any good salesman or saleswoman or salesperson will be collaborative. I mean, we'll look to form a kind of working partnership with the customer. We'll certainly be interested in finding out what the customer wants and what they value and what they care about, and be thinking, how does my product fit into what this person wants and needs? And certainly salespeople know that it's up to the customer to make the decision whether to buy or not. And so what else is there in motivational interviewing that isn't quite captured by those things? And the word that we've chosen, at least at present, and I want to emphasize this is a work in progress, even changes from week to week at this point. But the word we've chosen is compassion, a word that appears in just about every major world religion, and fundamentally means an interest in the other person's welfare, a primary focus on what the other person needs rather than on my own interests. So a salesperson using collaboration, evocation, autonomy is nevertheless trying to bring about something that will be in the salesperson's own interest, in which they have quite an investment. So here we're adding a kind of value judgment layer to this and saying, as we understand motivational interviewing, it's done with the primary focus of the other person's welfare in mind. The listserv has been very helpful and stimulating in our thinking about what where motivational interviewing is growing. And an issue that you've seen, if you've been on the listserv, is are we only talking about behavior change? Or could it be other kinds of change? Now, it depends how broadly you define behavior, but we're persuaded that, yes, indeed, you could very well have a change target that isn't really a behavior change. And an example is forgiveness. Someone who is struggling with an issue of whether to forgive, and the person that they're considering forgiving may even be dead, may be gone. This is very much an internal process, and yet clinically an important one, and one that we know has health impact. Or the decision to leave or to stay, a relationship or a job or whatever it is. Well, yes, it impacts behavior, but really you're talking fundamentally about a decision here. What about attitude? Someone might be interested in changing their disposition in a way to become a more compassionate person or a more assertive person. Now, that would have behavioral implications, but it also is kind of broader sort of change. And then thirdly, coming to some sort of resolution, which Alan Zukav, among others, has talked quite a lot about, the resolution of unresolved grief. Having made a decision, but coming to peace with it, because there is what Alan talks about as residual ambivalence. In the context of kidney donation, someone makes a decision to donate a kidney to a loved one that needs one, and yet may still have some doubts about it. And those doubts are related to adverse health outcomes. And so the resolution of those doubts before the person goes ahead with the donation is something important, to come to peace with the decision, or indeed reconsider the decision in some cases. Sometimes it may even be developing a tolerance and increased tolerance for ambivalence, for anxiety, for not having decided. And it's all right to be in this place. So there are a whole variety of kinds of change that aren't exactly behavior change, but nonetheless we think are legitimate topics to be considered in motivational interviewing. The word directive has given us lots of trouble. And we've defined motivational interviewing at times as being client-centered and directive. But directive means lots of things to lots of people and does kind of carry that expert model with it. And so we're trying to clean up that language a little bit. Now, directing is a behavior. Directing is something that you do in ordinary practice. It's giving information. It's offering advice. It's making direct suggestions. And in just about any practice, that's part of what you do. In the healthcare book, we put that at the opposite end of the continuum from following, simply listening and going wherever the person is going, with guiding in the middle. I'll come back and look at that in a minute. So there's a counselor behavior. Direction is a goal orientation. And motivational interviewing definitely has a direction to it. There's definitely somewhere you're trying to go. And so perhaps the word directional will be a better way of talking about it than directive, that there's a direction that you're trying to move in, but you're not likely to do that within a very taking control, directive kind of style. So we've been thinking about that language as well. This is the continuum of styles out of the healthcare book that we'll be carrying forward into MI3. From directing at one end to following at the other and guiding in the middle, with guiding being this interesting blend of directing and following. A guide whom you engage to help you when you go to a foreign country doesn't usually boss you around and order you when to arrive and tell you what you will and will not see, but is interested in what it is that you want to see and what it is that you want to have happen during your visit. And then the guide's job is to help that to happen in a safe and effective and enjoyable kind of way. So motivational interviewing sort of lives in the middle of this, but that doesn't mean you never give advice or never give information or never have a period of time where you're just listening to the person. It's a movement back and forth among these places on this scale. You can think of various therapeutic approaches as lying at different places along that continuum. So highly directive or expert focused things like Dr. Phil are at, or Dr. Laura out here, are at one end. Client-centered therapy, at least as conceptualized by Carl Rogers, was very heavily following. And not steering in any sense, but going with the person and trusting the direction that they're taking. And then in the middle, some approaches including motivational interviewing and solution-focused therapy, where it's very much a collaborative conversation between two people. Steve came up with this kind of mix of informing, asking, and listening, three behaviors, and what might you see as the relative mix of those in these different styles? Well, at the directing end of the continuum, you see a lot of telling and a fair amount of advice and maybe not so much listening. And at the following end, at the client-centered end of things, you see a lot of listening and some asking and maybe not too much information and advice giving. And in the middle, you may get a kind of roughly equal mix of those things. You get a balance of those. So it's just how much of these is happening. And one thing that Steve emphasizes often is that directing is often used way too much in helping professions, that healthcare over-relies on directing rather than guiding and following. Now, in doing the contrast exercises, in doing the persuasion exercise and taste of motivational interview in many different countries, I then ask how the speaker was responding to that conversational style. And there's a lot of consistency to what you hear across cultures. And we're kind of coming to three groups of responses that tend to be evoked by the writing reflex, by being directive and telling people what to do and giving them information and such. One of those themes is feeling invalidated, is feeling one down, not understood, not heard, not respected, feeling ashamed, embarrassed, and generally uncomfortable. It's not a fun role to be in. Another cluster is resistive behavior or defensive behavior, where the person may argue and discount and deny and be oppositional and procrastinate and such in response to being pushed to do something. And then the third, withdrawing. Some people just kind of shut down and get quiet and wait till it's over and get out of there as fast as they can, or just don't pay attention, so kind of drift off and leave and not come back. So So those three themes of feeling bad about yourself, feeling feisty and defensive and resistive and withdrawing and avoiding seem like common thematic responses to directing and to the writing reflex, teaching and directing. In contrast, what do people say in response to being listened to or in response to a motivational interviewing style? It's actually the opposite of those things. People say they felt accepted. They felt understood and heard. They felt comfortable. They felt safe. Felt empowered rather than hopeless and helpless. They feel accepted rather than defensive. They are accepting rather than defensive. So they're more open and undefensive, and in being listened to are more likely to be listening and taking in the information that's coming in and to be cooperative. And rather than to avoid, to approach. People say, I would come back and talk to this person again. I liked the person I was talking to. I felt very engaged. I felt very, very active in this process. So you've got these two contrasting styles of a directing versus a more following and guiding style. And I often say, which kinds of clients would you rather work with? Would you like to have clients who are defensive, angry, don't like you, and want to get out of there as fast as possible? Or would you like to have these clients who like you and want to talk to you some more and are listening to what you're saying and feel comfortable and hopeful because they're the same people? The clients you get are the clients you create to a large extent. All right, now what about definitions? Oh my goodness, this has been a lively topic. Yeah. How could you possibly not say the word ambivalence in the definition of motivational interviewing? One thing we've done is to say, well, however you define motivational interviewing, however long it is or for whatever the audience, it seems like there are three elements that ought to be there. One of them is that it's a conversation about change. So there's a subject to this conversation. Now, it doesn't have to be therapy or counseling. This is being used in lots of areas, but it's a method of communication, or it's a form of conversation. I've said if I called it anything else, it would have been motivational conversation, because it kind of captures what's happening. Secondly, it should say something about it being collaborative, not an expert down kind of approach, but something that's person-centered, that honors the autonomy of the other individual, that has that spirit of motivational interviewing to it. And then third, it should say something about being evocative, that you're calling forth from the other person their wisdom, what their ideas are, how they see the world, and are very interested in seeing the world through the other person's eyes and drawing forth from them their own motivation about change. We're thinking for this third edition about actually three different definitions that have a different purpose and that differ in their complexity. One of them for lay people, which answers the question, what is it? You know, what's it for? At the TNT said this is the elevator definition, that you're standing with somebody in an elevator for 15 seconds and they say, oh, what is motivational interviewing? And so you need one of those little quick stories. There's a practitioner's definition where the question behind it is, why would I want to learn this? Mm-hmm. And then there's a technical definition, which may be more than the person wants to know, which is how does this work? What's actually going on here? So let me take a look at where we are with those three at the moment. So the elevator definition, motivational interviewing is a collaborative conversation to strengthen a person's own motivation for and commitment to change. So something like that. That you're just explaining to a person, what is this thing that you do? You know, well, it's a conversation about motivation that is meant to bring out the other person's motivation and commitment. What about for the practitioner? Person-centered is something that is often meaningful, or patient-centered in medicine. A person-centered counseling method for addressing the common problem of ambivalence. So you get your ambivalence in one of these definitions.
Right, yeah.
Even though we're ambivalent about it. And then the technical definition, which gets more detailed, a collaborative, goal-oriented method of communication with particular attention to the language of change. It's designed to strengthen an individual's motivation for and movement toward a specific goal by eliciting and exploring the person's own arguments for change. Now, we will probably monkey with these words over time, but more I want you to get the sense of where we're going with it, that there are three key pieces that we try to highlight in any talking about what motivational interviewing is, and that the level or complexity of the definition depends on the audience. Who are you talking to? You wouldn't say this in the elevator, you know? Yeah. One of the biggest changes, though, is rather than disembodied principles and phases and so forth, is we struck upon four processes of motivational interviewing that seem to capture the length and breadth of it. And that's the way we're organizing the writing in this third edition. And in honor of the Irish, we have a four-leaf clover here. Yeah. Two of them have to do with the relational foundation, with forming the relationship that allows change to happen. And two of them are a little more specific to motivational interviewing. So the processes are engaging, focusing. We were for a while calling this one guiding, but decided that will get confused with the continuum of styles that I mentioned a while ago. So engaging, focusing, evoking, and planning as the four processes. And let me talk a little bit about each of those. Engaging. This, by the way, is Jasper, Terry Moyer's new puppy. So, yeah, oh, what could be more engaging than Jasper, right? Yeah. Well, this is what you do first. This is what any therapist does first, actually. You need to engage with the person. You need to form a relationship that is going to work, whether you're selling or whether you're doing counseling or whether you're involved in healthcare, whatever it is. You need to have a working alliance with the person. And so that becomes a very early focus. And if you don't do that, the person doesn't come back. You don't have any basis for doing anything further. Certainly oars appear immediately here. These are primary skills for developing that relationship and doing it relatively quickly. And really, as you know in your training, you need to get those things in place first. Because as you get farther into motivational interviewing, you begin to use those skills selectively and skillfully. And so they need to be kind of comfortable and somewhat second nature to take the next steps. So this is a good place to focus. And by the way, if all you ever teach the people that you're training is oars, you've done a pretty good job. Those are good helping skills in themselves. Rogers thought basically creating those conditions is all you need to do. And you can go an amazing distance sometimes with the more following oars kind of style. But it's certainly what's happening up front. Then focusing. Now what's happening is we're beginning to find a direction for the counseling process, for the conversation. Where are we headed? What's the goal of our work together? What are we doing together? Most often this will be what the client brings. Most often it will be the person comes saying, I would like to lose weight. I would like to be more forgiving. I would like to quit drinking, or, you know, whatever it is. So the goal has been brought by the client. There are situations in which the counselor has a goal that the client doesn't immediately share. Was that a nice British understatement? That was the situation for which motivational interviewing was originally developed, actually. And it was developed for addiction counseling, where a person's walking through a door that says addiction counseling above it. So there's no mystery about what we're going to be discussing here. But an awful lot of people who walk through that door aren't yet decided that that's what they want to do. They're still ambivalent about it. And so the client may not have the firm, committed goal of making a change, but by virtue of your role as an addiction counselor or a probation officer or a diabetes educator, you have a particular direction in which you are moving, or at least you would like to move. So there's that situation too, where you have a goal that's in the person's best interest, in your opinion at least, but they may not quite be there yet, and that's a focus. So either of those is a direction toward which you're steering. Maybe begin giving some information and advice here. That comes up also a lot in the fourth process in planning. Now, those two things happen in all kinds of psychotherapy and in all kinds of professional consultation. They're not unique to motivational interviewing. You need to engage, or the person simply won't work with you, or won't come along with you. And many kinds of therapy, although not all, move toward finding a particular focus, a goal that we're working together toward. Agenda setting process. We've talked about, we have a bubble sheet that you can, what are we going to talk about today? So it's just various ways of getting there. Now, what about the situation where you have a goal that the client doesn't currently share? That's the original scenario for motivational interviewing. And what about the situation where you're not really sure if you should be directing toward a particular outcome or not? And so another topic that you've heard discussion about on the listserv and that we had a symposium on at last year's forum is equipoise. Now, what is that? Some people think of equipoise as a characteristic of the counselor. I think the right word in English for that is equanimity, a kind of fairness, a balance, an objectivity, a centeredness that it's a good thing to have as a counselor. But equipoise, we think, is a decision. It's a conscious decision or an intentional decision that you make not to influence the direction of choice. So equipoise is when you actually want to stay out of the process and have the choice left entirely to the person and not be steering in one direction or another. That can be about the goal of your work together, or it can be about the means of getting to the goal. A common scenario in medicine is a patient with cancer who might, there are effective treatments that involve radiation. There are effective treatments that involve surgery. There are effective treatments that involve chemotherapy. And for certain kinds of cancer, also watch and wait is a reasonable strategy. And which of those are you going to do? In some areas, there's just really not enough science to say, oh, you're much better off doing this. And so the physician just stays out of it and does informed consent. Says, here is the outcome on this treatment and this treatment, and here are the chances with this one. Here's what tends to happen over time with this approach. And it's really up to you to decide your own healthcare, which way you want to go. And however you go, I'll work with you to move in that direction. But the physician is consciously trying to not root for one particular strategy, but says that's the patient's proper choice to decide which way to go, and that's pretty common in medicine. So, in a way, the question is, should I proceed strategically to steer in the direction of a certain kind of change? resolving the client's ambivalence in one particular direction? Or do I want to maintain neutrality, equipoise, and not either intentionally or accidentally steer the person in one direction or another? Because you can inadvertently steer without even thinking about it simply by reflecting more on one side of the ambivalence than the other, or asking more questions on one side of the ambivalence or the other. So I think, as we're reflecting on it, equipoise is actually harder than motivational interviewing. But what we've learned about language and the dynamics of change within a conversation is very helpful in maintaining equipoise. So let's take a look at that. Also, there's been some discussion about should the counselor ever have a goal that isn't immediately shared by the client, you know? Or should you always have equipoise? So let me suggest some scenarios. One that I described in the original 1983 article. A person who comes to you saying, I'd like your help in deciding whether we should have children. You know? Now, I would think most clinicians would feel like that's one you should not, not a decision you should be not making for the person, you know. You shouldn't even be rooting for one side over the other. You're talking about something with lifelong implications and potentially lifelong regret. And you know, you don't, either way, you know, and you don't want to, say, well, I think you should do is have children. You know, you're just not likely to do that directly. So there's one where, you know, probably most people would choose equipoise. Although, you know, you can imagine scenarios where that wouldn't be the case. If you live in China and the person has one child already and they're looking at having a second child, which is a big, big deal in China, and you're an agent of the government, you may have a different position on it. But what about a teen deciding whether to give up her baby for adoption? Yeah, that's one we probably would kind of want to leave to the person also. But you can imagine situations where you're kind of leaning a little bit, you know? What about a relative deciding whether to donate a kidney? Yeah, that, you probably want to leave that one in their hands too. How about an adolescent considering whether to use condoms? Well, do you have a leaning on that one? If it's your adolescent, yeah. Grandpa? Mm-hmm, yeah. What about a homeless person, and the conversation is about whether to get off the street? Because some homeless people that I know are pretty comfortable with life on the street. It's the life that they know. They know how to do it. They know how to survive there. They kind of like the freedom of it. You have a leaning on that one? Do you feel like you ought to be steering in a particular direction on that one? Or a kid, and you're talking about whether to stay in or leave a gang. Do you have a leaning on that one, or a spouse having an affair? Do you have a leaning on that one? You know? In my context, what about somebody who's mainlining heroin and methamphetamine? You know, pretty dangerous, high mortality stuff. Yeah, I'm kind of leaning now. That's one where it's pretty clear to me that it's in the person's best interest to help them move away from this behavior. What about a drunk driver? Is that a behavior you have an inclination to maybe change? Yeah. What about a depressed soldier who's been playing Russian roulette? Yeah. What about a pedophile who's contemplating his next victim? You know, I mean, there are situations where we have a pretty clear leaning of which way to go, and others where we pretty clearly think it's none of our business to do that. And then those gray areas in the middle where I don't know, you know, should I steer or not? You know? So it's sort of a continuum. Terry Moyers uses what she calls the waitress test, which I've always kind of liked, you know. Imagine a woman who works on her feet a long day for salary and tips, and part of what she earns goes to taxes, and those taxes pay for my salary. Mm-hmm. Would she be okay with me being an addiction counselor and not have any particular investment in what the outcome is. You know, I don't really care if this person changes their drug use or not. Would she be okay with me being a probation officer who, it's really kind of doesn't matter to me whether you offend again and I lock you up or not, you know? Does it make sense to that person on the street that we would be behaving with equipoise in this situation? In some of the situations I've talked about, it makes perfect sense that that's what you do. In others, you're wasting my money, you know, sitting there not helping the change to happen when that's what you're being paid for? You know? All right, so it's a decision process. The engaging and focusing happens anyhow. So you identify a change goal, and then there's the decision. Do I have an aspiration that I want to steer toward, in which case evoking and planning processes come into play? Or do I want to maintain equipoise? And if I do, what do I do? What do I do? Both of those choices involve equanimity of the counselor, so your fairness, your balance is still there. Both of them are collaborative. Both of them respect the autonomy of the other person. It seems to me that equipoise is where a classic decisional balance makes a lot of sense. In a classic decisional balance, you're giving equal attention, balanced attention, to the pros and to the cons. In what you ask about, in what you ask for elaboration on, what you affirm and what you reflect and what you put into your summaries, well, there's a balance in all of that. So you're trying to keep your balance in that process. And you know the 2x2 grid. What are the good things and not so good things about how things are now? What are the good things and not so good things about making a change? And spending time exploring all of those boxes and asking about them and reflecting it back and putting it into double-sided summaries. I mean, that's what you would do in working with ambivalence when you want to be careful not to tip the balance one way or the other and leave it to the person. That doesn't make sense to me when we get to evoking, which is the next process, where you're giving differential attention to the pro side. And so we come to evoking. This one is unique to motivational interviewing. I don't know of another therapeutic approach yet that does this, where we're looking to elicit certain kinds of language from the person that are their own motivations for change. So you're selectively asking questions. There are certain questions that are more sensible to ask, those to which the answer is change doc. And there are other kinds of questions that maybe it doesn't make so much sense to ask, like, why haven't you changed? You know? Yeah. You respond selectively to different things, as indeed Carl Rogers did as well. You're more likely to reflect change talk when it happens, for example. And when you put summaries together, it's not a random assortment of what went on. You're making a bouquet of change talk with maybe a few little sprigs of sustained talk in there just for color. You know? Yeah. Which comes around to what is change talk? Because in the second edition, although we changed the description from self-motivational statements to change talk, we kept the same definition or the same examples of what would constitute it. And the very next year, Paul Amrine's psycholinguistic research appeared, which changed our way of thinking about change talk substantially. Now, change talk is broad. It's any speech that seems to be moving the client in the direction of change. So you can kind of feel that when you're talking to someone. You don't know it's change talk until you know what your goal is. So until you've done the focusing, you can't do the evoking because you don't know what you're evoking for. Right? So change talk is relative to your goal. When I was talking to Soccer Mike, the referring goal was to do something about drinking. And when Mike says, I think my real problem is smoking, that's good change talk about smoking. It's not change talk about drinking, which was what I was steering toward. And so now we have darn cats. Yeah. Categories that emerged from Paul's work. And we're thinking of these in two classes. And it's pretty clear you don't need to be that picky about exactly which one of these it is. But darn, these desirability reasons need are examples of what we're calling preparatory change talk. It's getting ready. It's kind of on the way. You see this kind of change talk happening earlier in motivational interviewing sessions and getting stronger in motivational interviewing sessions. But it's not yet to action. It's not yet to I'm going to do it. You know. So I want to. Terry has this wonderful little exercise that many of you know, you know, where you have five answers. You have one person give each answer. One says I want to, which is desire. One says I could, which is ability. One says I have good reasons to. One says I need to. And one says I will. You know? And then you go down the line and ask the question, will you tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? I want to. I could. I have good reasons to. I need to. But the judge won't take any of those. No. I will is commitment language. The other one that Terry uses is, will you take this person to be your lawfully wedded spouse? And forsaking all others, stay together in sickness and in health, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, till death do you part. I want to. I could. I have good reasons to. That shotgun over there. I need to, yeah, but wouldn't take any of those at the altar. We say, no, I will. I do. Yeah. So that's a good one for separating preparatory darn from mobilizing cat talk, and mobilizing is the other kind. Now, Paul Amrein only talked about commitment, and so for a long time we had darn C. You know? There was darn, and then there was commitment on the other side of the hill, and that was pretty much it. But in coding, we began to run into some challenges. As people would say things that clearly were in the committing direction, but weren't, I will, I'm going to, I swear, I promise, I guarantee. And it didn't have that quality. One of them was what Terry calls taking steps, which is the person comes back and says, you know, I went 2 days this week without using. You know, they've actually done something that is a step in the direction of change. That's definitely on the action side of the hill. But it's not commitment. You're not saying, and I swear I'm going to never use again or anything like that. Or, you know, I went to an AA meeting this week. Or I did get the paper and I found jobs that are available and I called two of them. You know, so it's doing something in the recent past that probably since you saw the person last that moves them in the direction of change. Then there's other stuff that Paul originally classified with commitment as kind of low-level commitment. I'll think about it. You know? But it's not, you know, will you tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth? I'll think about it, you know. It isn't good enough in terms of commitment, but it's in the right direction, you know. I'm willing to, you know. I'm ready to, I'm prepared to. The person's telling you when they say, I'm willing to stop drinking, or I'm ready to do some things to get my blood sugar under control. They're telling you they're on the far side of the hill, but it's just a little bit different from commitment. So that's what we're calling activation language. And you don't have to get upset about whether it's a C or an A or a T. I mean, you can just kind of feel that it is on the other side of the hill. Right? And so here's the hill. Yeah. Get preparatory change talk, which is kind of the slog up the hill, you know, and mobilizing change talk, which is kind of a little more momentum to it going down the hill. And that's a metaphor we used even in the first edition. We don't want to imply that the mobilizing side is dead easy, you know, because that can be a whole lot of work too. And with this hill, you can easily conceptualize the stages of change as well as occurring along this continuum, that before you begin getting any preparatory talk, you've got pre-contemplation. Contemplation is about kind of balance, and you get change talk and sustained talk. Then when the person begins thinking about how they could do it, you're kind of in the preparation stage, and when they begin to take action, you're in the action stage. So I think that hill metaphor can work okay. We're giving more emphasis now in training to how you respond to change talk as well. So in the second edition, we spent a fair amount of time talking about change talk, although the way we talk about it now is different, and how you elicit change talk rather than sitting there and waiting for it. What can you do to make it more likely that you're going to hear change talk? But didn't give as much attention to what do you do next. And this again came out of Terry's coding lab and listening to tapes and what she calls missed opportunities, where there's beautiful little gem of change talk and nothing. It just is lost. It's as far as you can tell from the therapist's response, the therapist didn't even hear it or isn't responding to it. They're on a mission to go somewhere else and miss the process. So there are certain things you should hear the counselor do after change talk happens. And I've been using the acronym EARS, which is just ORS. But the O is a particular kind of question. It's an open question that asks for elaboration. You know, well, in what ways do you not feel well in the morning? You know, give me an example of the last time that happened. Tell me some more about that. Because when you ask for examples and elaboration, you're getting more change talk. And that's the purpose of the E response. Affirmation is another way that you might respond to change talk. A reflection is the most common way to respond to change talk, I think. And then bouquet summaries, where you're beginning to pull together elements of change talk and give them back to the person in a collected form. So all of those are reasonable things to be doing with the change talk that you hear. And we have some exercises now to have people actually practice hearing change talk and responding in one of these ways to it. Those of you who were at the change talk workshop earlier this week saw one of those. Jeff Allison came up with sustained talk as a suggestion for the opposite side of the coin from change talk, and we think that's pretty good. That's talking about the reasons for staying the same. And it can be desire. I want things to be the way they are. It can be an inability to change. I can't do it. It can be reasons for staying the same. It can be a need to stay the same. I have to drink in my job. I can't abstain. It can be commitment. You know, I'm smoking marijuana and that's all there is to it. You know, that's commitment language. Yes. Yeah. So, examples, I really like marijuana, desire talk. When you hear want, wish, like, those verbs, that's desire talk. I don't see how I could give up pot. That's inability language. Right? I have to smoke to be creative. There's a reason, an if-then. Mm-hmm. I don't think I need to quit. There's need or lack of need language. Mm-hmm. I intend to keep smoking and nobody can stop me. Yeah, that's commitment language. Yeah. I'm not ready to quit. That's the status quo side of activation language. And I went back to smoking this week. That's taking a step to stay the same. You know, so, yeah. Now that's related to resistance. In the first two editions, we lumped sustained talk in with resistance. And now we regret that. Now we see, actually these are different things. That when a person is talking about reasons why they're doing what they're doing, and why it might be difficult to make a change, they're simply telling you about one side of their ambivalence. There's nothing pathological or resistive or argumentative or, you know, anything about that. It's what you normally hear with ambivalent people. If you just sit and do following, listen to people who are ambivalent, they'll give you change talk, they'll give you sustained talk, and they'll mix them right together. You know, you'll hear them all tangled together in sentences and paragraphs. And that's not resistance. Resistance is something else. Resistance is still behavior. It happens in an interpersonal context, so you can't resist by yourself. You got to have somebody to push against, you know. It's a signal of dissonance in your relationship with the person, and it does predict non-change. So the very kinds of behaviors that Jerry Patterson was presenting 40 years ago predict a lack of change. A client interrupting you is predictive of non-change. It's something you're not hearing when a client's talking at the same time that you're talking. A client arguing with you, a client discounting you, saying, you know, who are you to tell me what to do? Do you ever use drugs? You know, I mean, that stuff is about the relationship. So if it's about the behavior, it's sustained talk. If it's about the relationship, that's dissonance or resistance. So we're making that distinction. Both of them are highly responsive to counselor's style. And happily, you respond to both of them the same way. So it's not like if it's sustained talk, you have to do one thing, and if it's resistance, you have to do something else. Whew, that's good. Basically, you reflect either way. So the response is the same. But I think it's helpful to think about this in different ways. I really don't want to stop smoking is sustained talk. I have to have my pills to make it through the day is sustained talk. You know? You can't make me quit. You know? I'm not going to quit and you can't make me. I'm not going to quit is sustained talk. You can't make me is dissonance. Right? Because it's saying something about your power relationship. You don't understand how hard it is for me. That's commenting on your relationship. Okay? Then we come around to planning. Planning is the bridge to change, and there's a next-door neighbor to implementation, which is what you're going to hear about in a little bit. This is what we called phase two before. But I think it's much more helpful to just think of it as one of the processes that's going on in motivational interviewing. It's thinking about how would it happen? How would you actually go about changing? And the ideal outcome of this is an implementation intention, which is a jargony term out of cognitive psychology. But basically, person having a particular plan and their statement that they intend to do that. That combination, a specific plan and a stated intention to do it, is strongly related to actually carrying through with the behavior. So if you ask me if I'll do something for you and I say I can do it tomorrow morning, you know, I've made a pretty good commitment. I've expressed my intention to do that for you. So then, is it MI yet? You know, is it MI yet? Well, let's look at it the other way. Can you be doing motivational interviewing without engaging? Nah. Can you be doing motivational interviewing without a focusing process, without having some direction to it? No, not really. It's not MI yet. Can you be doing motivational interviewing and not be evoking from the other person their own perspectives? No, you can't. Can you be doing motivational interviewing and not planning? Yeah, you can. You haven't gotten that far yet. You know? The mistake I made in one of our studies, as most of you know, was insisting on doing planning in the first session. Big mistake, you know. Got to have a change plan, whether or not the client's ready. You know, that's not a good idea. So, you know, perfectly good motivational interviewing, you just haven't quite gotten to a plan yet, and you may not get to a plan. That's all right. So it's motivational interviewing when the communication style and spirit are there, when you have a person-centered, joining, empathic style. That spirit's essential, and so there's the engage process. It's motivational interviewing when there's a particular goal and you're moving in that direction. That's the focus. And it's motivational interviewing when the interviewer is evoking the person's own motivations for change. Now, that's not to say it's wrong to do anything else. It's simply this is the combination of things that is the working definition of what motivational interviewing is and how it's different from non-directive counseling or other forms of work that you do with people. The four processes are somewhat linear, although we always get nervous about linear things, you know. But you do have to engage first. I mean, there's no question about that. If you don't do that, that's the end right there. And then you have to have a focus before you can evoke. So it's going to kind of come in that order. And you're probably going to do some evoking before you get right into planning, unless the person walks through the door in the action stage, in which case they don't need motivational interviewing. You're just ready to rock and roll, you know. And in fact, you shouldn't do motivational interviewing in that situation. When the person says, I want to quit drinking and I want to quit now, tell me how to do it. You don't sit and say, well, what are the good things and not so good things about it? No. Yeah. And yet, all of these processes are happening throughout motivational interviewing as well. So they're kind of linear and they're kind of not linear. I mean, you may have some planning talk pretty early. You may get some change talk right at the beginning, as Soccer Mike gives us, just a couple of minutes into the interview. We're still in the process of engaging, and there's some evoking going on. You don't do engaging and then, I'm done with that, now we're engaged, I can move on and forget those oars, you know. You have to re-engage, and the engaging process continues throughout your consultation. Focusing may involve refocusing, you know, kind of shifting the goal and changing a little bit how we're going and where we're going and how we're going to get there. Evoking is happening all over the place. And even planning. And so these are sort of iterative or repeating processes as well. They're also recursive. You know, all of them can begin early. You kind of test the water and see if you're ready to go. These aren't one-time events and then they're done with. And so we have a kind of stair-step image that is the best thing we can come up with so far, that engaging is a bottom step. It's foundation. And you're going to keep doing that throughout. You know? And having a clear focus is kind of a next step, but that also continues throughout. And then you begin evoking, and that process continues, and you begin planning, and it follows from what went before. And I think that we may come up with something better, but that captures it, I think, reasonably well, that the earlier processes don't go away. They're still there. They're foundational for what you're building on and what you're doing. So that's a fair amount of change. We still have a lot of work to do. We're maybe only a quarter of the way through writing at this point. We're shooting for next summer to be able to send it off to Guilford. And when Steve and I talk, we change our minds fairly often. So probably don't change your slides yet, you know, but maybe you'll find some of those ideas helpful in how you go about training motivational interviewing. And it's the direction that we're taking in this organism that keeps evolving over time. Thanks very much. So I think we've got a little time for counter-arguments, confrontation, refutation. Open questions. Yes, Vaughn.
So just one comment. I like using the word compassion.
Uh-huh.
I would be very wary about differentiating, though, from what takes place in selling. If you remember the other slide where you have different styles of doing therapy, so the same thing is true in selling.
Yes, I agree.
So that you can actually have people who have been trained in collaborative problem-solving selling.
Indeed, what Vaughn is saying is it's a little risky to use selling as the contrast point as if it had no compassion to it. And indeed, in marketing text that I'm taking a look at now, there's a tremendous emphasis on developing a relationship and wanting to have this customer over time and making sure you're looking out for their best interest as well as your own. So I don't want to use that as a foil. That's what you're saying. It's possible to do evoking and collaboration and autonomy without compassion, but let's not pick on somebody as the people who do that bad thing. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Mike. Mm-hmm. Well, you may work in a context where it's sort of taken for granted what your goal is going to be. You know, at least the goal, maybe not the method of getting there, but at least the goal. So when people walk into our center, the Center on Alcoholism, Substance Abuse, and Addictions, you know, they know we're not going to be talking about diet. You know, there's a subject of conversation. And indeed, the waitress who's paying my salary expects that I'm going to have some focus on addiction and not just be chatting about, you know, how you doing and how things going this week, but I'm going to be doing something to actually move in the direction of change. When the state hires a probation officer, they expect that person to be working on behavior change and protecting, with the goal of protecting the public. You know? And one route to that is offender behavior change. So does that mean you can't have equipoise in that situation? That's an interesting one. Yeah. I think you're unlikely to. I think you're unlikely to truly not be steering in a direction. And it could certainly be argued you're not doing your job if you really don't have a particular goal that you're moving toward when it says over the door what the goal of this is. But we're getting heavy into ethics here and kind of interesting issues. So, yeah, boy, all over the place here. Oh, you got a microphone. You get to pick the people who ask the questions.
Oh, I do.
Even.
Still, that's a lot of pressure.
I'll just maintain equipoise about who.
Two quick questions. You probably considered why you would use the word compassion rather than altruism. That was my first question. Why not altruism? The second is, why does focusing come more broadly than evoking? It seems that we are evoking as we set the agenda, and that would be more foundational.
Let me go back to the first one and then ask you to say the second one in a little different words. Why not altruism? I know it'd be all right, but I think you can have compassion and also have some investment of your own in the process. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, I have nothing to do with this and this is all about you. So I think you can have compassion in a whole variety of roles, and to me it seems to describe it a little better. Now say a little more about the evoking one again.
I just mean when we think or when I'm working with somebody and we're trying to set an agenda or focus, it's going to start with, well, what are you interested in? And I see that as an evocation question. So I would see if unless I'm understanding something incorrectly about evocation.
Yeah, okay.
More foundational. Because what are you interested in? What should we do? And then you start focusing it down.
The way we're using the term evoking doesn't describe that. That's an open question. It's a very sensible open question to kind of figure out where you're going. But the way we're using the term evoking is now moving toward a particular identified goal. So just a, you know, small stuff. Yeah.
Bill, since we're trying to teach the spirit of motivational interviewing, can we teach compassion?
Oh, of course you can. You can teach whatever you want. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Going back to the equipoise question, I think I'm thinking about this because I'm working with Alan Zuckoff on that same study about the kidney donation, liver donation. And I've been wrestling with whether it's MI or not. I think it is, even though the focus isn't on the outcome, the focus is on discussing the topic. And maybe I'm misunderstanding the focus, because maybe the focus has to be on the outcome instead of on the topic you're discussing and helping the person find the decision that's right for them. So I think I'm still wrestling with whether that's MI or not.
That's fine. And I mean, to me, it doesn't matter if it's MI or not, you know? Why are you doing what you're doing in a thoughtful way and how are you trying to get there? And I don't care if it's called MI or not. I mean, that's a temporary name for a general approach that we're all interested in and evolving, but I mean, who cares if that's over the line or under the line for MI?
Yeah.
All right, the granting agency may want to know if it's MI, yeah, okay. Yeah.
I kind of wanted to just go back to that question earlier, because if this is about that there is a goal, and it may be different, like I work for child welfare, so the sign above my, mm-hmm. is child welfare. But in a lot of contexts, sometimes I'm a facilitator, actually. I get called in to facilitate big meetings between different agencies and things like that. And it seems like during that process, until I figure out what people want, I don't have a stake in it. But once I do, once I see where the energy is and I see people light up around this or they this or that, or where they're stuck or that, I jump in there then and sort of go with them, hopefully, towards where they want to go. So at that point, I actually take, I don't know, I wouldn't say I kind of direct, but I make a conscious decision to go where they are, where I see sort of that flow going. So I don't know if that's equipoise or not, or when it becomes not equipoise, in terms of change.
You've nicely described the focusing process of not being quite clear and then becoming clear where you're going. And once you are, then you begin moving in that direction, which is the transition from focusing to evoking. So that's a very nice illustration of this process flow that we were talking about. Equipoise really is defined in relation to a particular outcome. And so when you don't have an outcome in mind yet, there's nothing to have equipoise about. It's a decision not to steer in a particular direction about a decision that's being made. So that's kind of, pre-equipoise or something. What is it? You're always starting off wondering where are we going, what's going to happen here, and there's an engaging and joining process and some focusing, and then you know where you're going. Say, okay, now I have a sense of how to get there. And again, usually you're going where it is that the client says they want to go. You're using motivational interviewing to help them move in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Bill, can I ask you, as I'm listening to you present yours and Steve's latest thoughts on your growing understanding of MI, I'm sitting here thinking this resonates very nicely with my own growing understanding of MI, and it's very sympathetic. And I'm thinking, that's of no great consequence, but here we are, the largest ever forum. I'm wondering whether you might want to invite the group to express the extent to which your presentation resonates with their own growing understanding of MI, whether we're working sympathetically.
And how would we do that?
I can pose the question for
now
you.
Now we're into planning, see?
Right, yeah. Can I ask the group then, as you were sitting listening to Bill, did you feel sympathetically that his growing understanding is yours? Raise your hand. Mm-hmm. There you are.
Feel better now? Yeah, okay. Thank you for helping, Jeff. That was great. Yeah. I mean, it's no coincidence this resonates to you, Jeff, because you've had such an influence on the way we think about things as well. Yeah.
It's a really nice setup for the comment and question I would have, and that is the term compassion itself really resonates within me. However, I think it's also a dangerous word in that it's used so loosely and so broadly in so many contexts. And the word literally means with suffering, and I think of it as part of that engagement process, that we have to walk with people in their suffering, in their dilemmas, in order to free them up to be able to contemplate change. And so I think it's a really powerful concept. The word care literally means to grieve with as well. So I think these are concepts that really enrich in MI. But I also think we need to maybe define it in a way that helps us see that. Yeah.
I mean, one thing that you see is happening, we're slowly de-jargonizing MI. And so these four processes are everyday words that can mean lots of things, so we're defining them in particular ways. But we've gone from developing discrepancy. When you say that to a physician, they go, huh? Yeah. And self-motivational statements and so forth, to language that's more accessible and not psychotherapy language in a way. So is compassion the right term? I'm not sure. We welcome suggestions. It's a piece that's missing. And what's the best word to use to capture that piece? and then we define what we mean by that along the way. It's one that leaps out of Buddhism and Judaism and Christianity and Islam, and I mean, it just appears all over. It's in the introduction of every chapter to the Quran. So it's a common human concept that that may capture what we're trying to say. One more question. Okay. I get to pick. Oh, Giampaolo.
Thank you, Bill, for this update. Very useful. The only problem will be to change all the slides over there. Lot of work. But still one issue is a little confusing to me. And it a little. That is how you combine direction with equipoise in when the goal of you as a professional, as a practitioner, or an employee of an agency have such definite goals, and you are also involved professionally, morally, ethically in those. That is a little puzzling to me. How can you save equipoise when you have to be directly committed to change?
Yeah, well, you may not be able to, first of all. I mean, one thing that happened in the Emmy study when we trained people in motivational interviewing and then tried to find them for a year afterwards was a fair number had left the place they were working and said, I could no longer work there after learning motivational interviewing. And some of that had to do with, you know, the things are so prescribed there, it just didn't feel right to me. So you may be working in a context where it's not easy or even legitimate to not have a goal that you're working toward with the person. It is possible to have an opinion about what's best for the person and still practice equipoise. That's an important combination too, that even though you think it might be best for this person to have children, you don't go there. You stay with the decisional balance and leave it entirely in the person's hands as best you can. And I think we know how to do that better now that we understand the psycholinguistics of change. Thank you.
We do.